You're listening to a message from Oaks Church Brooklyn. Our longing is to see heaven come to earth in our city. For more information on our church and community, please visit oaksbk.church.
Now I'm going to lead us in our teaching text. Today's reading is a paraphrase of 2 Samuel 11 and 12. The watcher of kings stood in the quiet, as power moved where it should not. Sovereign commands turn sovereign schemes, cast a piercing darkness over the weak. The just one saw but did not strike, not yet, not with storm nor sword. Instead, a story becomes a mirror raised, a prophet's hand pulling light from dark. The child weakened, the night stood still, yet no hand moved to turn back time. In the silent halls, the servants waited, fearing the weight of the word withheld. This is the story of God.
All right, good morning again, church. If you are new with us, I just want to catch you up real quick. We are in a series, The Story of God, where we've given ourselves moving through the Holy Scriptures, not canonically going through every book, not even chronologically, just necessarily hitting every story in order, but we've given ourselves to the story as a story. So we're moving narratively. And we're doing this in an effort to, one, see the Bible as it's been given to us as a story, but not just a story of humanity, but more importantly, the story of God. That through this story and as the Lord moves, we can get a sense of who this invisible God we love and serve today is, and how this God moves, and what this God thinks, and what this God feels. And this allows us, we see, to kind of understand this story in a new and different way. And in that hope, the scriptures become not a rule book, not a guide of protocols, or even a religious text, but it becomes something altogether beautiful and magical. It becomes a way to enter a deeper relationship with the God who longs to speak. And so to that end, if you haven't been with us, we're in this part of the story of God where the people of God, his people have turned into a kingdom. They've turned into a kingdom because they wanted a king. They did not want a God as a sovereign leader. They wanted a king like everyone else. But yet, as the Lord had foretold them, these kings, well, they make their life very volatile. And we're following lately the up and downs of the people of God through the ups and downs of these kings that lead them. Because nations typically go as their leaders go. And kings are volatile people. Because even before they have power and influence, people are volatile. March 3rd, 1968, Dr. King gave his last sermon that he would give in his home church of Ebenezer Baptist in Atlanta. And his theme that Sunday was about this volatility. It was about the tension between good and evil. He said this: "You don't need to go out this morning saying that Martin Luther King is a saint. Oh, no. I want you to know this morning that I am a sinner like all of God's children, but I want to be a good man. Every time you set out to be good, there's something pulling on you, telling you to be evil. There is a schizophrenia within all of us, and there are times that all of us know somehow that there is a Mr. Hyde and a Dr. Jekyll in us." A month later, King would be having one of his numerous affairs with a woman in a hotel in Memphis. And the next day, after that affair, he'd stand on that balcony and a shot would ring out, and that would be the last day he would live. And I just think about that, and I think about that phrase, you know, never meet your heroes. Because leadership, honestly, is letting people down at a rate they can handle. I guess this is why the psalmists, the poets of God's people said, it is better to take refuge in the Lord than to trust or place your salvation in humans. Because people are volatile, like even the good ones. We're going to come back into the story, and where we left off with the ordination of a good man, King David. The story goes that he was a man after God's own heart. Unlike his predecessor Saul, who had no relationship really with the God of Israel, David continually put his life in the hands of Yahweh. Time and again, he returned to him. Time and again, his actions were led by his relationship with this God. That is until one spring. See, as it goes, in the springtime, this is in the time when kings go off to war. And David sent Joab out with his men and the whole Israelite army, but David remained in Jerusalem. Now, we cannot bypass that. David is taking a turn here. Like, he should be on the battlefield, leading his men. But for some reason, we don't know why. What we can say is that he's more chiefly concerned with his desires than his responsibilities. He just doesn't want to go. And so he stays home. And this is important because as we talk about this story, what we have found is that in us, there is this thing, this chaos. And this chaos, what it means to be human, it can be good. It can be surrendered to the Lord, but it can also be bad when we try to order our chaos. When the Lord does it, he finds a way to make our chaos something that leads us to life. When we order it, it often ends in death. And our circumstances influence our chaos. The places we find ourselves, well, they become a force on whether we will yield our chaos for good or to bad. That night in the spring, David goes up on his rooftop. It says that David got up from his bed and he walked around the roof of the palace. And from the roof, he saw a woman bathing. And this woman, she was very beautiful. So beautiful that David was not content even just stealing this glance. No, he had to know who she was. And so David sent someone to find out about her. It's interesting, usually what we know of David in times of curiosity, he inquires of the Lord, but this day he goes to his servants. And they come back and they tell him, oh, that woman, that's Bathsheba. She's the wife of Uriah the Hittite, one of the leaders in David's army. The thing about power is that power distorts perception. David wants, and so David takes. David sends his men to go beckon Bathsheba, and who says no when the king calls? So Bathsheba comes to place herself before her king, but not in the way I think that the king intended. David, the man after God's own heart, he proceeds to rape Bathsheba. Ironically, on that night as she was bathing in a purification ritual after her menstruation period. And so she was out there devoting herself to the Lord, making herself clean before him. And here she comes before the Lord's anointed and he defiles her. And this Lord, Yahweh, he's silent. Some time passed, we don't know how long. Long enough for Bathsheba to realize that she has more than just the horrible memories of that night. But she has a child. And so she tells the king, I am pregnant. Now David is clearly has not been a perfect man. And one thing about David, typically he is a man when faced with his misdeeds and when faced in times of failure, he turns his heart to the Lord. But this time, he turns his heart to schemes. When the woman conceived, she sent word to David and she said, I'm pregnant. And so David sent this word to his general, send me Uriah the Hittite, her husband. The general obeys because you obey the king. And so Uriah comes home and he comes to the palace and David wants to send Uriah on a little bit of leave. You know, Uriah, you look a little tired. How about this? Why don't you go home? I'm going to send you with something nice. Why don't you spend some time with your wife? Long before the days of DNA, David considers, well, who could know? But turns out Uriah is a noble man. And so the next morning when David awakes, he finds that Uriah hadn't gone home, but instead Uriah has spent the night sleeping at the palace with his men. And David is like, what are you doing? Did I not give you a gift? Did I not give you this leave? And Uriah says, how could I go home and eat and make love to my wife and have a good time where the men that I lead sit and sleep in the cold? So I stayed with them. David can respect that, but he's not one to give up. And so he says, Uriah, okay, come back tomorrow. Tonight, you're going to stay at the palace again, and I want you to eat with me. And as the story goes, David, he rolls out the huge feast for Uriah, and he gets him drunk. He gets him drunk, and if you've ever seen the movie, It's a Wonderful Life, when George Bailey walks out of the door and says, if you would just point me in the way that I should go. David points Uriah in the way of home and gives him a shove. Go home! But even it appears when he's drunk, Uriah is noble. And David again finds him asleep with his men. When deception fails, deviousness arises. And so David escalates from rape to murder. The wise men of Israel, they have this saying that evil deeds of the wicked ensnare them. The cords of their sins hold them fast. Later, one of the apostles of Israel would say, each person is tempted when they dragged away by their own evil and desire and enticed. Then after desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin. And sin, when it is full grown, gives birth to death. There seems to be this truth that those who become ruled by their desires do not find themselves to the way of life, but to the way of death. And not just death for themselves, but often death for others. The next morning, after his second failed attempt, David writes a letter to his general after he sends Uriah back to the battlefield. And in it, he wrote, put Uriah out front where the fighting is fiercest, then withdraw from him so he will be struck down and die. This mighty king, this shepherd king, this humble king now invites his general into his own chaos. And this general receives orders to betray one of his soldiers. And he does, because we obey kings. It said that when Bathsheba, Uriah's wife, heard that her husband was dead, she mourned for him. But after the time of mourning was over, David, he brought her in her house, into his house, and she became his wife. And that son born of David's lust, was born. And that God, David's God, the one who anointed him, the one until now who has been silent and distant, standing apart from this story, we find that he hasn't actually been so distant, but he's been watching. And it says that the thing that David has done displeased the Lord. And so the Lord has to confront David. There was this office at this time, the person of the prophet, and these were the people that operated as the mouthpiece of God. They carried the word of the Lord, particularly to kings. The prophet at this time was a man named Nathan, and he gets a call to go to David and to confront David. But the Lord doesn't send Nathan with a shout or with a harsh tongue. He doesn't confront David outright. Instead, he tells a story. Here's the story. Nathan comes to the king and he says, King, there is this issue. Well, there was this rich man, and this man had cattle on a thousand hills. This man had so many flocks. And in his same city, there was this poor man who only had one little lamb, but man, like Mary, he loved this little lamb. So much so that he would sleep with it. He'd share his meals with it. One day, a traveler is passing through and it goes to the house of the rich man. And as is the custom in these days, when you are entertaining a stranger, hospitality extends both ways. The stranger pays respect to the house, but it is imperative that he who owns the house opens the door and makes sure that his guests have all that they need, including a full belly. And so this rich man, what does he do? He prepares a meal for his guests, but he doesn't use any of his many sheep. Instead, he goes to the man who only has one, the one he so richly loved, and he takes that sheep and he kills it and he serves it to his guest. David is at times, and most times, a noble man. And so this he cannot abide. The story goes that David burned with anger against the man and said to Nathan, as surely as the Lord lives, this man who did this must die. Then Nathan, summoning the future voice of Mari Povich, you are the man. Three times David denied the Lord with his actions. And now Yahweh, David's Lord, has a dilemma. He must be faithful to himself. The Lord has always been faithful to his people, but he must always, and maybe even more so, be faithful to himself, or he would not be a God worth serving. There is no other choice. But what does he have to be faithful to? Well, listen, be reminded of how this Lord speaks of his own self. Yahweh, the Lord, the God of compassion and mercy, I am slow to anger and filled with unfailing love and faithfulness. I lavish unfailing love to a thousand generations. I forgive iniquity, rebellion, and sin, but I do not excuse the guilty. I lay the sins of the parents upon their children and grandchildren. Their entire family is affected, even children in the third and fourth generation. This is how the Lord introduced himself to his people, and he does not change. And so he stands before the man after his own heart. Still a God of redemption, but also a God of accountability. And a God who allows sin to flood so that people can remember and know and turn from their ways. Why did you despise the Lord by doing what is evil in his eyes? Nathan says on behalf of the Lord. You struck down Uriah the Hittite with the sword and took his wife to be your own. You killed him with the sword of the Ammonites. Now, therefore, the sword will never depart from your house because you despised me and took the wife of Uriah to be your own. This is what the Lord says. Out of your own household, I am going to bring calamity on you. Before your very eyes, I will take your wives and give them to one who is close to you, and he will sleep with your wives in broad daylight. You did it in secret, but I will do this thing in broad daylight before all Israel. There is a wisdom for those who sustain themselves through agriculture. What you sow, you reap. What you plant, you harvest. One cannot put apple seeds in the ground and delight for the day of watermelon. So the Lord tells David, what you have done will revisit you. And now David, in the face of this accountability, he returns to his Lord. I have sinned against the Lord. And here again, the Lord is faithful. Nathan says on his behalf, the Lord has taken away your sin because he shows mercy to thousands and thousands. You are not going to die, but by doing this, you have shown utter contempt for the Lord. The son born to you will die. This was a true word. This is the hidden nature of disordered chaos. Unsurrendered sin, it ruins people and their families and their communities, particularly the innocent. For all his faults and vices, Dr. King, he was trying to bring order to this country of ours, like demanding that this country lives into all that she promised to be, all that she could be and would be only if she would put down her base desire for gain on the backs of others. And when he was assassinated, when the chaos of this country took his life, it too spread everywhere. Over 100 cities were burned. 39 people died. 2,000 people were left homeless. 5,000 were jobless. Neighborhoods took decades to recover. This is the legacy of ordering our own chaos and not adopting the way of Jesus, individually or corporately. David pleaded with God for the child, the story goes. He fasted and spent nights lying in sackcloth on the ground, and the elders of his household stood beside him to get him up on the ground, but he refused, and he would not eat any food. On the seventh day, the child died. And David's servants, they were afraid to tell him the child was dead, for they thought, while the child was still living, he wouldn't listen to us when we spoke to him. How can we now tell him the child is dead? He may do something desperate. Their worries feel justified. And while David did not do something desperate, what happens next? Well, it shocks his servants to the core. We'll explore that next week. As we move ourselves towards reflection and response to this story, I want to go first. Like, what does this story say to me? When I read this story, I am reminded that what we do in this life matters. I go back to this idea of sowing and reaping. You know, Paul would say that a man reaps what he sows. Whoever sows to please their flesh from the flesh will reap destruction. Whoever sows to please the Spirit from the Spirit, he will reap eternal life. So let us not become weary in doing good. For at the proper time, we will reap a harvest if we do not give up. Let's not grow weary in doing good. Time and again, David just like exhibited such dependence upon God. So I don't know what it was that sent him on this path, what made that spring day different. I imagine sometimes as it happens and I see in my own life, there's a thing that Malcolm Gladwell calls moral licensing. I've done so much good, I deserve a break. I've been faithful so long, I can give my desires a taste. Just a little bit of the chaos. I wonder if he just felt, I always do the right thing. What's the worst that could happen? And I'm reminded, particularly for those in power, but for all of us, what devastation happens when we just let the chaos in our lives run amok, when we become people just driven by our own desires. Not having our desires, but being driven by them. As I tell my son, it's okay to feel your feelings, but your feelings belong to you. You don't belong to your feelings. He doesn't listen. Yeah, I'll play him this podcast. Before we move to our time of questions, I also want to reflect on, where is Jesus in this story? Like, we know he's coming, but we know that he's been here since the beginning of time. So where is Jesus and where is salvation? Where can we see him? For me, it's in this baby boy. Like, he would not be the last innocent son whose death would be required because of sin. And that confronts me because, honestly, there's a part of me that rises up with indignation at the Lord. How could you let an innocent baby die? Willingly, you chose it. And then that anger and that righteous indignation rise up in me, and then the mirror gets raised, and I think about the reason that Jesus had to go to the cross, because of my sin. Because of the ways I refuse to let the Lord order my chaos, and the ways I willingly chose to send an innocent son to death, and I still do. And it leads me into, I think, the epitome of Lent, weeping and mourning that I am a man of unclean lips and a people of unclean lips, that I am the chiefest of sinners. And I am in need of a Savior who will order the chaos in my life.